may be seated. Thank you. Next case set for argument this morning is Charles Burkhard versus Tammy Jo Burkhard. Aaron Schoenbeck Byrie is arguing on behalf of appellant, and Nicole Carper is arguing on behalf of appellee. Each side will have 15 minutes for your initial argument, and then Ms. Schoenbeck Byrie, you'll have a 5-minute rebuttal. So with that, you can proceed with your argument.
May it please the court, law clerks, and my friend at council table. I'm Erin Schoenbeck Byrie. Like you said, and I represent the appellant mother in this situation. Today, the court has before it a novel child support issue. I think my friend at council table will not dispute with me that the facts are pretty straightforward in this case, and they're not in dispute. We have two parents here, a father and a mother, who have two children together, a son and a daughter. They originally had joint physical custody of the two children, and then through a change in circumstances, daughter switched, and she went under the primary physical custody of mother. Son stayed under joint physical custody of both parents. The issue then arises, what formula is to apply in these split custody situations? The figures to be imputed to the formula aren't in dispute. Both parties agree on each other's income and the withholdings of those incomes. This is solely a legal matter before the court regarding the formula.
Can I ask a more fundamental question? And I've read in your briefs and your comment here that this is a legal question. I also read in the briefs that this is a question of statutory interpretation. Is it really?
Mother advances and I argue yes. Because
what statute are we interpreting?
It'd be more so statutory interpretation discusses that you have to look at the chapter as a whole.
To come up with an a new rule that doesn't exist.
And we would advance that SDCL 25.7.6.23, which is the split custody statute, would be part of your interpretation here.
But we're not interpreting that statute. We don't need to. We're not looking. That will not provide the answer. Everyone agrees with that, right?
It provides, it's not a perfect fit is what I will say, but it provides the guidance to ensure that we have continuity in our state amongst split custody situations. So while is there an exact statute that you're going to be picking apart and saying, well, if it says one thing, does it mean another here? No, but we have to look to that statute because it provides the guidelines to apply in split custody situations.
But we're not looking to the statute for the answer.
We would honestly advance that, yes, you are. That statute does have the answer for what
but
formula to apply.
Interpreting the statute doesn't provide us with the answer because interpreting the statute yields an answer that doesn't apply to this situation. Everyone seems to agree with that.
It doesn't. It provides a formula, I would say, but are you looking at it word for word?
Everyone agrees there is no statute that governs this situation.
Yes, that there's no perfect statute for it, but that's
it. The best arguments, and by the way, the advocacy was excellent and very thoughtful, but the question is really more fundamental. Are both sides asking this court to come up with a rule that should be a statute?
I guess the fundamental question is the best body to solve this problem the legislature? Yes, and I think both parties would agree with that there's no perfect statute, but we need to have a formula that every parent in the state can apply.
What authority do we have to come up with a formula?
Well, prior case law, for instance, when you had income that was above the statutory guidelines, this court came up with the original interpretation that it has to be based on the needs of the children, and then that formula was applied until the commission looked at it, said, yeah, this is a good idea, adopt it, and then the legislature adopted it. So that's what's going to happen. We would advance that that's what should happen today.
But now we have a comprehensive statutory enactment, and the 6.2 statute says that everything has to be established in accordance with the schedule, which this cannot be. The 6.1 statute said the parents are jointly and severally liable to provide for their children. No one's really saying that these kids are not being provided for in some way.
Mother's advancing that the formula that the referee adopted and then the circuit court adopted robbed those children of their base support amount.
Okay. I'm going to let you get back to your argument, but I have some questions about whether this case is even cognizable for us.
Perfect. So Before the court can look at the appropriate formulas to apply to this situation, it must address the first issue briefed by the parties, and that's whether the circuit court erred by allowing father to supplement the record over the objections of mother in violation of SDCL 257A-22. And what that statute, during the hearing, father over the objection of mother sought and did enter into the record the both oral and written testimony of Thomas Keller. His testimony was coached as an expert opinion. He testified that he's been a family law practitioner for 35 years and provided been a referee for 15 years. He then provided an expansive history on our child support statutes argued which formula was that was to apply.
Counsel, can you flesh out for me how your client was prejudiced by the entry of that information into the record since the court ultimately adopted the referee's formula?
So, first of all, I think the standard got a little skewed within the briefing of what standards to apply for prejudice, and that's whether the decision of the court was substantially influenced by the admittance of Mr. Keller's testimony. And you can see that the court was influenced by the testimony in a number of ways. First of all, he was coached as an expert opinion. So the statute explicitly says you can't supplement the record, and then when an expert opinion is allowed to be entered in, he wasn't the referee in the underlying proceeding, that's going to sway the court. But more than that, you can look to the actual transcript itself, where the circuit court discusses the weight of the testimony on his decision. The transcript, which is appendix at 25, the court says that this testimony is necessary for his review of the issue and for his review of and for this court's review. He then, in concluding, says he was interested in the reports and the testimony that was provided, and he wanted to review it all before making his decision. And then finally, the prejudicial nail in the coffin was when he attached Mr. Keller's written opinions to his order. And so each of those three established that it influenced his decision, had a substantial influence on his decision, and mother was ultimately prejudiced by it because during the objections hearing, father was advancing or advocating for the referee's formula.
And if you prevail on that argument, what do you want us to do about it?
Send it. We do think the issue of the guidelines or the formula that needs to apply in this situation must be addressed too, just so that there's guidance across the state for what's going to be happening in these split custody situations. But on that issue alone warrants remand. But again, the courts, for the sake of judicial economy, it gets remanded, a decision is ordered, it's probably going to be appealed right back up here. So I think we would advocate for that the guidelines also be addressed beyond that error.
And if this is a de novo review, the court determines it anyway, we aren't deferring to the circuit court's determination anyway, right?
Yes.
So, I mean, and if not necessarily that this is the necessary route, but if we were to find that somehow there are facets of the existing statutes that come into play in terms of what the appropriate calculation would be here, and there's ambiguity, this court could then look to some of the historical information that he ultimately testified to, if it were in front of us, and this is maybe more of a theoretical question, but would you agree with that?
Would you, that some of the references he made this court, well, they'd be legal. He testified on legal issues, so ultimately this court could look into the legal issues, but I think it was error for him to supplement the record, but ultimately the legal arguments that were discussed at the hearing, can this court review them? Yeah, it's de novo review, and especially in these circuit court proceedings, it kind of opens the door for everything that occurred, and this court can review all the legal determinations. But I know the issue that's of paramount concern today is the second issue addressed in our brief, which Justice Salter already alluded to, and that's whether the circuit court erred by adopting the formula created by the referee and then ultimately adopted by the court. Mother's advancing today that this court should adopt a formula that's rooted in statutes already enacted by the legislature for similar split custody arrangements so that we have continuity amongst our split custody calculations within this state. During the original appearing before the referee both rejected both mother's and father's proposed formulas and ultimately created or formulated his own formula, which took a two-child primary custody calculation, divided it by two, and then took a two-child split custody determination, divided it by two, and then added the two results together. We advanced that this was a legal error. The reason this was a legal error is because his formula was not based on any statute. It was based on public policy arguments and equity determinations. No statute provides that any child support calculation can simply be divided at two or divided by the number of children to arrive at the amount of custody that's allocated for each child. That's just not based or not found in any statute or any legislative guidance that we see.
How do you respond to the criticism of Mother's formula in that it has, in essence, Charles paying more in child support than he would in standard two-child parental custody calculation?
Yes. First and foremost, that's not the issue before the court. This is one, two, a split child and a primary child. But more than that, Mother's is the only formula that's guided by statutes. The other presented ones had no statutory guidance. But even more than that, Mother advances that her formula is the starting point. What do I mean by that? The starting point that first you calculate the separate child support arrangements for each parent, and then it doesn't deprive or nullify the other child support statutes that we have within the chapter. So, like is the case now, then the advocate for the parent can come forward and say, hey, wait, though, this result needs to be altered a little bit based on whether it be SDCL 257.6.14 due to abatement, saying that, well, I already provide these resources for it, so a percentage should be decreased. We have SDCL 257-6.7, which has a deduction for other child support offered to other children, so that could be argued too, to reduce the income. We also have SDCL 257-6.29, which was recently enacted in the omnibus bill, and that talks about how if there's an unjust or inappropriate result, that it can be altered if it's in the best interest of the children. So while Mother's formula is the starting point, there's still that opportunity for attorneys to advocate on their client's behalf for a reduction in the support amount that's ordered based on the statutes that we currently have in place.
So under 6.23, your view is that the dominant child, we start Mother's calculation with the primary custody number. But the statute provides that if the parents have two or more children between them, each parent has primary custody of at least one child. And so that is the circumstance here. Mother has primary custody of just one child, but the father doesn't have primary custody of the child.
Yeah, so what I would say that the tenor of that statute is that split custody decisions are where you have decisions where you have more than custody arrangements. So you have a primary, whether it be one or two children with primary or one or two children with split custody, those have to be calculated separately for the scenario, and then you see what it is for each parent, and they can be offset from one another like what it is in the statute. Here you had a split custody, which resulted in father paying mother $627. You had a primary custody, which resulted in father paying mother $1,387. So those two added together to reach the child support amount.
But then the isn't offset subtraction?
Yeah, but then... Sorry. Father's offset amount was zero because in this situation he didn't have anyone in his custody, so he didn't have, mother didn't owe him child support for anything. If he would have had one kid in his custody, one primary custody of third child Zane, then Zane's calculation would have been deducted from the amount that he owed to mother, if that makes sense. So then you would have the distinct custody arrangements like the legislature enacted, and then you still have those offsets. And this ensures that we have the same split custody formula for every party that comes before the court.
One of the arguments made with regard to Mother's formula is that it ignores the economies of scale that are built into the base amount when there's primary custody, because in reality she didn't just have one child in custody with the shared custody arrangement, at least for half the time or whatever it was. She really had two. The argument was that formula ignored the economies of scale with regard to that determination.
Yes, Your Honor. And well, first, it's a policy argument. I think that we don't need to look to those policy arguments. We have a statute that provides guidance for formulas that are to apply in split custody determinations. More than that, father gets the economies of scale through his cross-credit deduction with son. But even more than that, if they had a third kid, then you would get that economies of scale deduction here. But in this distinct situation before the court, the legislature has said that in these split custody determinations, the different custody arrangements are to be calculated separately, and then offset from one another. So they've already determined, you don't need to look to the economies of sale policy argument because we have SDCL 257-6.23, we argue, that provides the guidance that we need. So with that, Your Honors, Mother's advancing today that instead of adopting a formula that is created, manufactured based on public policy and equity, that it instead adopt a formula, which is Mother's, which is based in our state statutes, SDCL 25-7-6.23, to ensure that we have a consistent child custody, or split child custody calculation for all parents that come before the court. Thank you.
Thank you, Counsel. Carper, you may proceed with your argument.
May it please the court, counsel, clerks, and audience. My name is Nicole Carper, and I'm here today advocating for the father's position in this appeal. I think the questions that the court has already asked in its comments to the appellant in this matter suggest the difficulty with the so-called solution that's being urged by the mother in this matter. It seems to me that the majority of the case that they're making to this court is to say, look, you don't need to speculate, you don't need to make a rule, because there's a rule that's already been adopted by the legislature, and specifically that rule has been codified into SDCL 257-6.23. The reality is, however, is that statute does not apply to the facts of this case. But I do think it's interesting to look at that statute and perhaps more importantly look at the history of what happened as far as jurisprudence is concerned before that statute was passed. And of course, I'm directing the court to the case of Stefan versus Peterson, which was the case, I think, that was the genesis of the legislature ultimately adopting a statute that recognized that we needed to have codification or direction to the citizens of the state of South Dakota, to the judges, to the lawyers, and to the child support referees as to how to handle what we're going to start calling hybrid situations.
So having come to that point and now beyond, is the legislature's authority, which has exercised, preeminent, exclusive?
Well, if we look at the history of the way that that statute in particular evolved, I would say no, because in the Peterson case, the judge in that scenario was forced with trying to determine an appropriate way to calculate child support when we had one parent having a primary custodial relationship with one child and the other parent having a primary custodial relationship.
But as you said, that was the genesis for
the creation, I believe, of the statute.
So we're there.
That's what I would say.
So we have this comprehensive, or seemingly comprehensive, it doesn't account for this situation,
mm-hmm.
but we have that. So does the court have the ability to formulate public policy and say, you know, this one got missed, so we're going to come up with our own formula, just like the legislature did in every other instance?
Well, I think what the court is forced to do in this case is, first of all, just make a basic determination as to whether or not the child support's referee was clearly in error. I mean, you don't need to necessarily make...
What standard would we judge that by? There is no statute which governs it.
In the same way that the court was forced to evaluate the solution that was developed by the trial court in the Peterson case. And that was the solution that was evolved in the absence of statutory authority, because there wasn't any at that time, that told the judge how to evaluate that scenario of each parent having primary custody. So the court said in that case, we're not going to overturn what the trial court and what the referee did in this matter because we find it consistent. We find it, I think the language, if I'm not mistaken, is it was rational, reasonable, repeatable.
We still have the 6.1 statute that says the parents are jointly and severally liable to take care of their kids.
Sure.
And has to bear some relationship to their means.
Exactly.
That's not a statute, obviously, and it may well be a codification of a common law precept, but does that have any applicability in a case like this?
Well, I think it does to the extent that, and that in conjunction with reading the legislative history with when we first came up with the child support statutes, I think in the mid-80s, and then the commissions that meet roughly every 4 years and talk about different ways in which they're going to make recommendations for modifications to the statutes. And I guess what I would say is there's clearly a very strong reliance and favor given to the notion that the rules that are developed to ensure that we have equitable and appropriate child support calculations and processes for individuals in the state of South Dakota is that they're rational, reasonable, and repeatable. And those theories, when you look at the legislative history or the reports from the Commission on Child Support, reference that over and over again when they're contending with hybrid situations or situations that have not yet been addressed by statute. So I appreciate what you're saying. Is there a specific statute on point that tells this court what to do? No. Is there a more generic statute on, that talks about what the responsibilities of the parents are? Yes. The question is, I think, really in this case is, can we say as a matter of review that the decision that the referee put forward to deal with a hybrid novel situation that is not addressed by statute, is it of such a result that it leaves you firmly convinced that an error has been made? And I submit to you that the answer to that question is no.
Counsel, would you stress test the referee's formula for the addition of additional children to see if it was have a rational, reasonable, and repeatable result?
I did some scenarios out. What I would say to you is I do think that it is important to note that given certain economic situations, and I think it would address more specifically families where you have higher joint combined income, you are going to be getting into an area where we're not going to see the same consistencies as we see for what the heartland of cases would represent. But I would suggest then the solution that's advocated by mother in those particular instances are perhaps more appropriately looked at, where you look at deviations in those instances, rather than what I hear mother saying is, well, yes, in this particular case, under this particular set of financial circumstances, the fact that father pays $9 more than he would if mother had primary custody of both children, that's unfortunate in the effects of this case, but that could be remedied by using the deviation factors in the other statute. Well, that's going to create a mess. We're not going to have consistency and stability in that way because almost every scenario will fall into that. But when we're dealing with very high income earner levels or very low income earner levels, frankly, I don't know that the statutes as a whole perfectly address those situations and the schedule as a whole perfectly addresses those situations. But that's why we highlight those sections and that's why this court has said in those instances where we have that variability, then we look to other statutory guidance, doing a deviation or something of that effect to address that, what we hope will be unusual rather than heartland cases, if you will. Well, what I would expect and what I saw with multiple children, for example, if the scenario is that you have one child who's in joint legal custody and the other three children, for example, where it's primary, non-primary, I believe that the statute, the process that was recommended by the referee in this case would address that appropriately. We all, I think, understand that the first child in any child support consideration amounts for roughly 73% of what the overall cost is. And you can see that in the schedules because for every subsequent child, the number doesn't double and triple and quadruple. There's economies of scale there. And that economy of scale and that recognition, I think, would still be the case employing the referee's hybrid model, if you will, of handling a circumstance such as this. Is it perfect? No. Are there going to be cases that will not perfectly fall into a rational expression if we're using this particular calculation? But perfection, I don't think, is attainable with any of the statutes, or if this were later expressed into a statute, you're always going to have a scenario that won't perfectly fit that.
So should we review it with some degree of deference? I mean, the brief suggests this is a legal issue and that we are applying a de novo non-deferential standard of review. I'm still trying to figure out how that works and what bright legal standard allows us to have that. So is maybe more deference?
I would say to you that I think when the language of statutory interpretation was used in briefs by both sides, what we were perhaps more by the mother than from us, but clearly you will look to the statutes as an expression of the legislative intent as to what the goals are in developing our statutes relative to child support and what the goals are in making any changes to those or why we make changes to those, and not so much that there's a strict statute on point that you need to give deference to. So my submission would be this is basically a de novo review in terms of how this scenario plays out, with the exception of the fact that I believe the limitation being that the referees and by extension the trial court's affirmance of the referee's decision should not be overturned in absence of a finding by you.
So if we reverse, we would be saying we think we have a better view of what the legislature would do as far as public policy than the circuit court did.
I believe that is essentially what you're saying. So thank you for the opportunity to speak
before
with you.
Before you conclude,
yes.
Ms. Harper, Shirley, did you start that at 10 or 15? Seems like maybe it was 10.
Oh.
No, another five. You got another five. If you want it, you don't have to take it. But.
I would be happy to answer any questions that you have right now. At this point, I didn't have anything more I wanted to expound upon. I could speak briefly as to the arguments raised relative to Mr. Keller's testimony being new evidence. First of all, I think that everyone involved in this case knew that we were dealing with a novel situation and that it's one that's been creating, I think, a lot of problems across the state. And that's obviously not ideal. And it does put referees and trial courts and now this court in a position of trying to figure out the best way forward. The arguments that Mr. Keller made, if you will, or the illustrations, I think, is the way I would characterize it, was simply an effort to help the court look at the different options that could be out there. Not to say that the referee's decision was wrong, but just to say here's different ways you could do this.
That may be really good and pragmatic, but there's a statute that says it's supposed to be decided based upon the record developed by the referee, so there's that.
But there was nothing that supplemented the record. No new factual findings were made. No evidence was presented. It was simply argument. So whether
I don't take anything from your advocacy because it's been excellent by both lawyers throughout, but it almost seemed like father had another lawyer. Mm. And I guess maybe that could raise another whole host of whether that was a good idea or bad idea or fair or not fair. Mm. But it was just more legal advocacy. Mm. But still, it wasn't in the record.
Sure. And I think it is important to recognize that that information was all included to the pleadings and submissions that went to the court in advance of the hearing itself, and that is part of the record. So there was nothing new there. So to the extent that it was sprung upon them or anything like that, I don't think anyone's suggesting that that was the case because those arguments were clearly, I don't want to say briefed because it wasn't that formal, but they were included in the submissions to the court that went to the court prior to the hearing being held. I think that nothing about the arguments that was made by me and then as described by Mr. Keller that day were different than the position that had been taken by us leading into that, frankly, in front of the referee himself. So I would submit that there was no evidence that was taken, there was no supplement to the record that was been taken, and I think that is belied by the fact that if you were simply to strike Mr. Keller's testimony, what you'd be left with is the trial court making the finding that what the referee did was absolutely consistent and appropriate and did not warrant the trial court overturning any of those findings. For example, to say, rather than use the referee's model, which was not the model that was advocated by us necessarily below, if he were to say, well, that was an error referee, we want you now to use the model that father recommended below, that would be a different situation. But that's not what happened here in this case. So with that, I thank the court for its attention, and I appreciate the ability to present father's arguments relative to these issues to the court. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Burton. Ms. Schoenbeck, Myra, you can proceed with your rebuttal.
Thank you, Your Honor. The court has long gone away with child support determinations based on public policy and principles of equity. It is stated that our child support statutes are mandatory and must be followed. Accordingly, Mother advances that the formula that must be applied here is hers. It is the only presented formula that has any statutory basis or that is guided by our state statutes.
But the question really is not whether there's some, you can make some extrapolation or argument from that statute that applies. The question is, was there error in how the support was set in this case? So specifically with that notion is, how did the referee or the court err in applying 25.7-6.23?
Yes, Your Honor, and this is addressed extensively in our brief. The issue with the referee's formula is that it presumes that there's a base, or that there's an X amount of support provided for each child in the state of South Dakota. If that were the case, you could go before and say, I have three children. And they said, okay, at this income level, three children times $60 per month per child is this. That's not how our statutes are created. The commission based the statutes and the guidelines based upon an income shares model. So what does that mean? What happens? So you have a base amount that was determined to be allocated for each child in the state of South Dakota. That base amount increases with the income of the parents based upon the theory that child should share in their parents' wealth. When the referee divided the formula by two and split it in half, Fowler discusses that 73% of expenses are allocated for the first child, where then he essentially cut away from that base amount that's necessary to raise a child in the state of South Dakota. That base amount is based on an economic study that the commission uses or extrapolates on the guidelines to come up with it, to determine what it is at each income level. So the referee's formula robs the children of that base amount of support that the legislator determined was a necessary allocation for each child. And in our brief, we outline kind of the example of showing that the guidelines, it doesn't incrementally increase with each child. It's a smaller amount, so it's being cut, that base amount of child support is being cut with the referee's formula. So it's a legal error to say that there's $60 per month for every child in the state of South Dakota. That's not how our guidelines are formulated. And in fact, the guidelines are mandatory and they should be the starting place of any formula. Mother advances that her formula pays homage to the guidelines and the statutes that we have in place and ensure that that base amount is not taken away from the children. So today, like I said, the court is faced with which formula is to apply. Regarding issue one, I'm just quick in advance that the statute, Justice Salter hit the nail on the head, it explicitly says it's to be solely. Solely is the word the statute used in 25.7a-22 on the record that's established before the court. Father was permitted and did enter into the record expert testimony. Mr. Keller acted as a living treatise during the child support hearing, and the circuit court within the transcript agree that it was a supplementation of the record. Accordingly, that's a reversible error. But more than that, Mother requests that this court look to the child support statutes and adopt the formula that's rooted in split custody determinations. The legislature has already provided its insight on what's to happen when there's two different custody arrangements within one family. It says those arrangements are to be calculated separately and then offset from one another. Here, the father's offset was zero, and mother's, when it calculated, equated the amount advanced at the circuit court level. Accordingly, we request that mother's formula be adopted today. Thank you.
Thank you, counsel, for your arguments. We'll be in recess for 10 minutes.